I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, two conversations about interrogation. We'll begin with, what is waterboarding? Then, are the wives and children of suspected terrorists now also being secretly detained? But first to Pakistan, where that country's deposed Chief Justice is speaking out as more clashes erupt over the decision by the President, General Pervez Musharraf, to impose a state of emergency last Saturday. The deposed Chief Justice, Iftikhar Chowdhury, says he's under virtual house arrest in his official residence in Islamabad. He spoke by phone with lawyers of the Islamabad Bar Association, telling them it's time for sacrifice, vowing that Pakistan's constitution would be restored and that there will be no dictatorship. Christian Science Monitor correspondent Shahan Mufti joins us from Islamabad. And Shahan, what is the significance of these comments from the now sacked Chief Justice?
Well, Robin, the Chief Justice emerged as a very unlikely hero of the mass movement against the military rule of Pervez Musharraf in March, when the president tried to remove the Chief Justice from his position. So he has symbolic importance, especially in the lawyers' community, that looked up to him to keep the lawyers' movement, at least, against Pervez Musharraf's rule continuing. And his comments today are really the first public comments ever since he was dismissed and put under house arrest.
It's time for sacrifice. I mean, you know, what is the interpretation?
There's little avenues left for the political opposition and the social move, the broader social move against the Pervez Musharraf now. So it is a call in some ways to take to the streets, which is something that the political parties have also been now slowly calling to. And the lawyers have already tried out on Monday, taking to the streets from their bar associations and getting pummeled in the process.
But is the call being answered by anyone besides the lawyers?
The political leadership of all major political parties right now is either under house arrest or in jail. But today, Benazir Bhutto has said that she is going to bring her party, that she is calling on her party workers and supporters to take to the streets, and that she will in no way be negotiating with Pervez Musharraf as long as this status quo remains.
Well, of course, we're going to ask you next about that. This is former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. She told the Associated Press the government has decided to postpone elections for at least a year, but no announcement has been made. And she challenged Musharraf to prove her wrong by coming on TV and telling the country otherwise, you know, that the elections would go ahead as planned. So she has, you know, as you said, spoken out, called on her party. What's the sense of the line that she is walking?
The line that Benazir Bhutto has been walking for many months now, Robin, is very unclear, and he's obviously doing a very delicate balancing act between Pervez Musharraf and the opposition. There's immense pressure on her now, as the only leader not under house arrest or in jail, to take a side. Through her statements, it seems like she is now taking a stance that will be welcomed by her
followers,
supporters of the
yeah.
opposition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's still unclear about what line she's taking. As far as the elections go, this is not completely surprising for people to be in the cabinet and the government to be discussing a year delay. That's what an emergency would have been suspected to have meant for many when it was introduced a few days ago.
Yeah. Shahan, what's the mood there? Of course, you know, the few pictures that we get are of these battling lawyers. You know, are people going about their business? What's the mood there?
Life is going on, Robin, as it must, I think, in this country. Places of business are still open. Offices are still open. People are still going to work. Obviously, I mean, there is tension on the streets. There is uncertainty on the street and homes. People are very uncertain of what is to come. The third day after the emergency was a relatively quiet day, actually, and that was to be expected after the lawyers and some opposition were pummeled yesterday in the streets. So it's an uncertain time, but there's also it seems like now the political opposition is starting to organize. There's at least one political opposition leader, Imran Khan, who has avoided house arrest, and he's calling on his followers. And so it seems like the political opposition seems to be organizing now for a street movement, which might come out in the next couple of days.
Shahan Mufti, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Islamabad. Shahan, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The Senate Judiciary Committee this morning voted 11-8 in favor of Judge Michael Mukasey becoming the next Attorney General, despite concerns that he's refused to say whether the interrogation tactic known as waterboarding is torture and therefore illegal. Committee Chair Patrick Leahy voted against Mukasey, saying that the Bush administration is sending a strong signal.
The United States government is basically saying to Americans, you go abroad, you're on your own. If you're tortured in this way, we don't know whether we'll come to your aid or not. Have we stooped that low?
Judge Mukasey had written lawmakers a letter saying waterboarding is repugnant, but that he couldn't comment on whether it is legal because he hadn't been briefed on the issue. Well, today, Republican Lindsey Graham, a former military lawyer, said he believed that waterboarding is illegal, but he voted in favor of Mukasey.
He is the right guy at the right time because unanimously, those who have been before him in his court have nothing but glowing things to say about his independence. They respect him as a judge and that he truly is a man of the law, exactly what we need.
Well, waterboarding is one of the central questions in Mukasey's nomination. But what is it exactly? It's been reported that CIA officers who subjected themselves to the technique as part of their training lasted an average of 14 seconds before caving in. But critics say it doesn't produce good intelligence. Joining us from Washington is journalist and CIA expert Ron Suskind, author of The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. He'll give us a backgrounder on waterboarding. And Ron, what happens when someone is waterboarded? Vice President Dick Cheney once called it a dunk in the water, which conjures up the image of a fairgrounds game, you know, when you throw a ball and someone gets dunked. It's also called simulated drowning, but critics say the simulating part is the wrong word. What exactly happens?
What happens is you're placed on the board, strapped to the board, your feet are higher than your head, and a cloth is placed over your face, and they start pouring water on the cloth. Now, what's interesting about it is the cloth creates a kind of dispersal effect in terms of the water going in virtually every orifice. That would be your nose and your mouth. And essentially what it is, it's drowning. Because the water fills up your nose, your nasal cavity, your throat, and your lungs, and generally then you go unconscious, just as you would if you were drowning. The whole point is that you ought to think that this is the last moments of your life. That's the way it works in an actual interrogation.
We know that the deputy U.S. Attorney General wanted it tried on himself, and it was once used by the U.S. military to train CIA and military personnel, and that was stopped. Why?
Well, because it just crushed their morale, frankly.
Because you know, they couldn't last.
It left them damaged. And because it was such a harrowing thing. Now, mind you, harrowing, and they knew that it was an experiment and they would be standing upright soon enough. If you're in an interrogation and they're saying, we're going to kill you, and then they do this, this is an expectation which will feel quite real that you are dying.
When did waterboarding originate as a form of interrogation?
This technique has been used since the Spanish Inquisition as part of the family of water tortures. It was used by many folks since. The Khmer Rouge used it. It was used by the Japanese. It was used, by a variety of armies in interrogation.
You mentioned the Japanese. In 1947, a Japanese soldier who used waterboarding against a U.S. citizen was sent to prison.
Yeah, he got 15 years hard labor. It was seen as an affront and something you do not do, even in a state of all-out war, like the Japanese and the Americans were in.
Well, this was the Americans that sent this Japanese soldier to prison for committing a war crime. But in 1968, a front-page Washington Post picture showed a U.S. soldier pouring water on the face of a North Vietnamese soldier. So the U.S. used it even after sending the Japanese soldier to prison.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you get situations in which soldiers doing what they're doing, often in desperate circumstances, say, what do we have in the toolkit and what will we try? And it's been a push and shove over years where folks have said, okay, let's try this, and then afterward often said, we shouldn't have done that.
Well, U.S. military personnel have been told by the Pentagon they cannot use waterboarding. Congress passed John McCain's anti-torture law, remember that, but we know President Bush signed a signing statement afterwards saying he didn't have to abide by that law.
That's right.
So the question remains, is the CIA, which is not the military, still using waterboarding as a technique?
waterboarding is still something the CIA can do. How much they've done it is a question that, frankly, has not been made clear, and it may not be made clear until there's some latter stage of investigation as to how much it's been used. The administration says it's been used only in a handful of cases on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, on al-Libi, the first captive, on Abu Zubaydah, another early captive. But the fact is, I don't think we really know how often they've used it.
Well, you and others have done investigations. I'm thinking of Brian Ross, also of ABC News. What is known, as far as we can know it, about how effective it was on people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the 9/11 mastermind?
Well, it's interesting because I think what we generally know is what we've known for a long time about waterboarding. People put under this duress generally spit up anything that they can say to stop the pain or stop this sense of imminent death. Some of those things may be of some value, but many of those things are not of value, simply anything they can say to make the pain stop. And I think that when it comes to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or others on which this has been tried, there is a very sort of mixed record as to the value of the things they said under this kind of duress. Ultimately, the balance of history and experience shows that these techniques are not worth their cost. Virtually everybody in the debriefing so-called community agrees about that. Because at day's end, you don't want the person just basically to spit up a few things as they try to keep from choking to death. You want them to talk to you for a long time. And that generally happens when you work more subtle psychological techniques in which you build, believe it or not, relationships between a captor and captive.
Has there been bad information garnered from waterboarding?
No doubt about it. Abu Zubaydah was certainly one who was waterboarded. And after waterboarding and various other types of duress, you know, he was basically talking about countless targets in the United States, pretty much anything he could think about.
We understand that even al-Sheikh al-Libi was subjected to waterboarding, and he gave bad information.
Yeah, and in fact, he gave some of the core information that Colin Powell would then speak at the United Nations, which I think Powell would say was the most regrettable moment of his life, what turned out to be at the core of the fictional reports that the United States used as a justification for war.
But, Ron, what about the hypothetical situation? I know you've heard a suspect, then you know that there's an event that's going to take place, and he knows what that event is, let's say a bomb that's going to wipe out all of Manhattan. And you've got several seconds to get the information. Advocates of waterboarding say this is the time when it should be used.
You know, the model of an imminent nuclear attack in the United States and a captive who can tell us where that is frankly, not something that we have faced. And it's not entirely clear that waterboarding would necessarily be the best way in which to get said person to say the thing that we need.
Ron Susskind, author of The 1% Doctrine, Deep Inside America's Pursuit of Its Enemies Since 9/11. Ron, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, and just ahead, another aspect of interrogation, and perhaps a new front in extraordinary rendition in Africa, where wives and children are being secretly detained with suspected terrorists. That's still ahead. Later in the show, Napoleon, art collector. Back in just 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The dark prison was run by the Americans. It wasn't Afghani people flying the aircraft. It wasn't Afghanis who sort of shackled me and did whatever they did to me. It was Americans.
That's Bishr Al-Rawi, a former detainee, coming out of the shadows to speak for the first time on U.S. television as part of the new Frontline World documentary, Extraordinary Rendition. It airs tonight on PBS. The program examines the U.S. government's controversial program in which terrorist suspects were picked up by the CIA in foreign countries and flown on so-called ghost planes to allies like Egypt for interrogation. And then, as the rendition program evolved, they were sent to what became known as black sites, secret CIA-run prisons in Poland, Romania, and as we just heard, the so-called dark prison in Afghanistan. Many detainees were released months, even years later, without any charges, and many claimed they were tortured, perhaps subjected to waterboarding, by American interrogators. Well, Stephen Gray reported the documentary. He's also author of Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA rendition and torture program. It's now out in paperback with a fascinating update that's also in the new film, and he joins us now. And Stephen, after these CIA, these secret sites became news, President Bush said that they had been closed and the detainees moved to Guantanamo. But in your film, you take us to a new terrain. You say the rendition program has been exported to Africa. Explain.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's been such a lot of controversy about rendition, about secret detention. You're seeing an evolution in how rendition is occurring, and I think the US is moving a little bit into the shadows. But for what happened this year in Somalia and is actually still going on, the Horn of Africa, thousands fled the fighting in Somalia and dozens were picked up, possible terrorist suspects they were called, fleeing the conflict, picked up in Kenya and held secretly. They were actually rendered, not in American planes, but in Kenyan and Ethiopian planes to secret detention in Ethiopia. A lot of people involved, nearly 90 people, and what was striking there, for the first time in the rendition program, we're seeing women, not terrorists themselves, but like wives of terrorists, and their children. There were four women that gave birth in secret detention in Ethiopia, and at least 12 kids that were held there as well. And they seemed to be questioned not about any crime they'd committed themselves, but what they might know about the whereabouts of their families.
This is an open detention. The detainees actually spoke to television cameras at one point, and the Prime Minister of Ethiopia defends the practice. You say these were just the wives of the detainees, and he says otherwise. Let's listen.
You have international terrorists with their wives and children sheltered in Somalia. You find the wife, you don't find the husband, and the wife is fleeing the battlefield. You do not know whether the wife is just a wife or a comrade and a colleague in the act of terrorism.
But another Kenyan, I believe, tells you that sometimes the family members of the suspected terrorists are used as a lure.
To smoke them out is the word he used. That was an interpretation also given by a former FBI special agent, Jack Clunan, who was one of the people in the Al-Qaeda task force in the FBI who helped to hunt for the terrorists in the Horn of Africa after the African embassy bombings. And he was talking about the same woman who was detained, the wife of one of the wanted terrorists there, Fazul Abdullah. They detained her many times before, and he said it was quite standard practice to pick up people like her in order to bring out the person they're really looking for. He said that you have to regard these terrorists as family people who would actually be seriously affected by knowing their family were in custody. So it seems to be an acknowledged tactic.
And children as well.
Well, the children were with their mothers. I don't think they were questioned, but their DNA samples were taken, presumably in case they grow up to be terrorists.
You know, and there were horrific attacks at two embassies in Africa. There's, you know, concern on the part of the White House that these have become, you know, Kenya, Mombasa in particular, have become sort of a breeding ground for new terrorist activities. But let's be clear, this rendering of suspects from Kenya on Kenyan planes to Ethiopian jails, is this a U.S. program?
Well, the answer is that the FBI and the CIA, for example, deny that they ran these renditions. The people were brought to Ethiopia, where they were questioned. All the people we've spoken to, which is quite a number, who were held there, say they were questioned by U.S. interrogators. Diplomats that we spoke to told us that this was a rendition that was organized for the United States' benefit, if not directly orchestrated. That's certainly the view of the FBI's Jack Clunan. There's no direct proof that the flights were paid for in cash as to who actually was behind the whole thing. Well, but what you see there is countries under great pressure to cooperate with the United States, to tackle al-Qaeda, to detain people who are wanted, in particular by the United States, for the embassy bombings. Mm. The role of transporting, rendering people, of holding them in secret detention is being handed out to local governments, but they're being placed in a position in secret detention where they can be questioned at American convenience by anti-terrorism officers.
It would seem, and this, it seems the conclusion you come to is that it's sort of back where it started.
It's going back to outsourcing, exactly. You see a whole evolution in rendition, actually, where just after 9/11, when there weren't CIA secret prisons in place, some really, really important al-Qaeda captives, the first key leaders of al-Qaeda we captured, were rendered into other people's custody, particularly to Egypt. And then you had the establishment of CIA secret prisons, where the majority of people that the CIA particularly wanted to question were held by the CIA itself. And now you have a dramatic reduction in that, where due to great public pressure and international outrage, the number of people held directly by the CIA is being minimized. It's not been eliminated. There are new orders in place to allow it to continue, but the whole thing has been dealt with kid gloves.
Mm-hmm. Just before we let you go, one aspect when this, you know, when your reporting and other reporting came forth a while back, some of these Gulfstream jets that were being used by the CIA to render suspects around the world, you know, were owned by people here in the U.S. who in some cases said they didn't have a clue what the plane was being used for, including the Red Sox plane, the Red Sox team plane?
It was a Gulfstream jet that was owned by one of the owners of the Boston Red Sox, has the Boston Red Sox logo on the back, but was rented out for weeks at a time for the CIA. And it was actually this Boston Red Sox plane with the logo covered over. They didn't actually leave the logo there of the Boston Red Sox during CIA renditions. That was the plane that was used to transfer Abu Omar, this preacher in Milan, who was kidnapped by the CIA and taken to Cairo, and for which the CIA people responsible are due to be put on trial in Italy in absentia in the coming months.
Just an odd footnote. That's Frontline World reporter Stephen Gray. The documentary Extraordinary Rendition draws from his book Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA rendition and torture program, which is coming out in paperback with an updated version. The film airs tonight on PBS. Stephen, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, thanks.
Okay, after the news, can you inherit bad financial judgment? That's coming up in the next half hour, Here and Now. We want to revisit a story today that surprised us because of the huge number of responses it provoked. It's about help for compulsive hoarders, people with a problem that hides behind closed doors until it literally spills out. Here's a quiz. Do you have so much clutter in one room in your house that you can't use that room? Do you have a tough time throwing away things other people would keep? Or throw? Oh, no, rather that they would throw away. Do you have a tough time passing up something when it's free or a bargain, even if you don't need it? Are you answering yes for yourself or someone else? These questions are posed in one of several quizzes in the book Buried in Treasures, Help for Compulsive Acquiring, Saving, and Hoarding. Dr. Gail Steckety is co-author. She's also a Boston University professor of social work. We spoke to her earlier this year and asked her to describe what she meant by compulsive hoarding.
I mean that there is really a lot of clutter.
And like a lot? Like how much is a lot?
It's hard to find the floor in most of the rooms in your home. If you can find the floor, what you've got is often a path. And then what you have are stacks or piles of lots of different kinds of things mixed together, 2 feet, 4 feet, sometimes even ceiling height. It's clutter and it's chaotic. Yeah. Well, it's interfering.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because we probably all know people who have that kind of a scene, but they're happy and they're active.
Well, it depends on whether or not it really interferes with functioning. So somebody actually can't function. They can't use their sink to rinse stuff out in. They can't cook. They can't sit down at a table and eat a meal. And that starts to become non-functional, even though they may not be ready to do anything about it yet.
Is it a psychiatric disorder?
I would like to think that it probably is a psychiatric disorder, but at the moment we would prefer to call it a behavioral syndrome. A lot of people think that it might be an obsessive-compulsive disorder, but there are a number of differences that don't quite fit that model as well as one would like.
Do you know if it's genetic?
There are genetic features, but they're not well defined at this point, and we're far from being able to say it's a genetic problem of any kind.
Well, and it may be a problem for the person who's the hoarder or for someone else.
Tell us,
you have these great stories in the book. Bill is one. Neighbors complained about the condition of his house. He came to your co-author, David Tolan, for help. Tell us about the situation in the house, because you've seen others like it.
Absolutely. What happens in this kind of situation is often that it spills from just interior space so that it's now out on the porch, it's out in the yard, then it's out in the front. It becomes part of the sidewalk. The neighbors get upset.
Let's rush in to say, this isn't an issue of poverty or class. This seems to cross
everything. It spans the range.
Yeah. So what was Bill's yard like?
Old appliances lying around, old tires, lots of old gardening equipment that certainly will be useful someday. And then just trash. Often a lot of what ordinary people would consider trash and would just run around and bag up if they could.
And what did Bill say about why he had it?
These are things he wanted. These are things that would be useful.
We've described how it can be dangerous for someone's mental health to be, you know, almost trapped in this, but I'm imagining it can also be dangerous in other ways.
People have died. They've died in fires. They've died in avalanches in their own homes. They've died from structures that can no longer support the weight of the objects in the spaces.
No, that's not urban legend. You know, you hear the stories of the papers piled, newspapers piled so high.
No, in fact, on my way to work not long ago, I remember passing the home that I knew was a hoarder's home. And at that point, there were fire trucks all around, and it was two-thirds burned to the ground. And I know that the man who lived in it died because they couldn't get him. They couldn't get to him.
Mm. So how do people who have these compulsions get help? Because as you write in the book, talk therapy doesn't seem to be helpful for people with these hoarding problems.
Right.
What is the kind of therapy that works for them?
We do a lot of practice, and we do a lot of helping people think differently about what's going on when they're attracted to something and want to get it, or when they're trying to get rid of something and they're tremendously ambivalent about doing so, or they feel that they have to hang on to it.
Let's role play. Let's just hypothetically say I have caned chairs that I've recently taken out of the garbage because
and
a neighbor
they're
was
all broken.
They're yeah, but you know, you could fix the seat.
Of course.
And I have absolutely no room for them in my house, but my 13-year-old nephew might have an apartment someday and might need them. Mm-hmm. How do you get me to move those chairs out of the house?
Well, first I want to ask you, Robin, what is it that led you to bring them into the house in the first place? Why do these seem important to you at the moment?
Because they were so abandoned. they looked abandoned out there.
Uh-huh. So in your mind...
And they could be used.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you have the idea that they have feelings, and you've also got the idea that they could be useful, and perhaps you're being a little irresponsible by just leaving them there.
So I'm hearing that in this therapy, you would try to direct this person away from the clutter and towards their feelings.
I've got to know why they collected them and what it is that these chairs really mean to them. First, we've got to agree that there's a problem and that they would like to get rid of some things. Then we can figure out which things would be easier to work on and which ones harder, and which ones make more of a difference in their life if they got rid of those. Shall we work in the kitchen, for example?
You know, I was half kidding when I said that there was this emotional reaction to these chairs, only half. But I'm wondering, you know, given these situations that you describe, how painful does it ultimately get?
Very, very painful. For most of the people we're seeing, there is a powerful identity tied up with these objects.
How does it come on? Is it something that people can not have and then suddenly this compulsive hoarding start having it?
Very gradual onset for almost everyone we've seen. You can actually track it back to the teenage years where they recognize a point at which they started to hang on to stuff more than the people that they knew, more than their friends. Then by the time they're in their middle 20s and early 30s, they've started to realize they have more things than they quite know what to do with, but they can function. They're fine. And then they get into their 40s and they find that they have a lot more and they can't control the acquiring. So they're starting to have functioning problems, money problems, can't do things they want to do, can't have people over anymore. Mm. And by the time they're in their 50s, and our most common age of people coming in for treatment is right at about 50, they've become seriously dysfunctional and they're very upset with themselves. And other people are upset with them as well.
The bulk of your book is a workbook. Essays, make lists, benefits, disadvantages of doing a certain thing. Mm-hmm. And that kind of clues us into, I think, the last thought on this that we can get to today. You can't do this overnight.
No, you can't do this overnight. We're usually talking about 9 months to a year. Every now and again, we'll have someone who could do it in 6 months or a little more, but that's really rare.
Mm-hmm. The book is Buried in Treasures, Help for Compulsive Acquiring, Saving, and Hoarding. We've been talking with the co-author, Dr. Gail Steckety, a Boston University professor of social work. And you say the book came out of other books that you've been using professionally for therapists and for people to do their own exercises?
Yes, we have a therapist guide and a client workbook that have grown out of our research on treatment for this problem.
And for more on that work, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Note to myself, pick up those chairs from the caning shop. Before we go today, Napoleon's art, you're listening to Here and Now. Well, we also want to play a game today that might shed some light on you and your relationship with money. And I'm probably going to make another embarrassing revelation as I play. With David Cesarini. He's a doctoral student in economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, right down the road. David, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, I understand, I can see it on the table, my producer has given you $20, and you're going to divide it between us. What are the ground rules here? What are we doing?
My role is to propose a division of this money, and you can then either accept it or reject it.
What happens if I reject it?
Well, if you reject it, we both earn nothing.
Oh.
And if you accept it, we're paid in accordance with the proposal.
Excellent. Okay.
Right.
Go right ahead.
So the split I'd like to propose is 9 to you and 11 to me.
9 to me, 11 to you.
And that's a take it or leave it offer. It's an ultimatum.
That's not fair.
Right.
I'm tempted to turn this down. That's not fair. But if I turn it down,
you are nothing. So in a way, you'd be incurring a cost if you reject this offer.
Because I'll be rejecting 9 free dollars.
Right. And that's the interesting thing about this game, that when people originally played it, they thought that, you know, any narrow theory of self-interest predicts that it's better to take something than nothing. But people feel, I don't know how you felt, but people feel insulted, or they feel that it violates their norms of fairness, and they routinely reject this free money.
Well, I'm going to take it just to get $9 off of Chris Ballman, our producer.
Great. And I have money for my cab ride home. So.
Right. But the fact is that statistically, do people reject it?
Yes. In this case, a 55% split, perhaps a lot of people would accept 45%. But once you go down to 20, 15, 10%, people very routinely reject.
In all likelihood, people will reject even 5 free dollars.
Yes. And the interesting thing is that this has been replicated in a lot of countries, a lot of cultures. They've even gone to hunter-gatherer societies in Africa and South America and found the same results. So there seems to be something universal about this.
Well, this game is a classic experiment. It's called the ultimatum game. And you've taken this and done further research to see if there's a genetic reason, a hereditary reason, why people make that choice to either accept or reject it. What'd you do?
So we used a very classical twin design to study this question, where we compared identical twins who share the same genes to non-identical twins.
300 pairs of twins in Sweden. And what did you discover? What did the identical twins who shared the genetics with their parents do that was any different than the non-identical twins?
So the identical twins who have the same genes, it turns out that the degree of similarity in how they play is much, much, much higher than the degree of similarity in how fraternal twins play. That is non-identical twins.
Which tells you what?
Which tells you, at least suggests very strongly, that people's response to these unfair offers are under genetic influence, because if you're trying to look at how parents transmit traits to their children, it could be through genes, but it could also be through environment. But by comparing twins, they've both grown up in the same family, so presumably they've had roughly the same environmental influences, and yet the identical twins who share the same genes play much more similarly than the non-identical twins.
So what can we do with this information? I'm thinking one thing might be to notice, if you notice that a parent makes certain decisions that you're starting to notice, gee, why did that parent reject that situation that might have been the better one, then you might learn that you have to fight against that same impulse in yourself.
That's certainly one interpretation. To me, the way I look at this is just that this nature-nurture, I realize that these are nebulous concepts, but this question of nature and nurture is a very foundational one. It's hard, if you go back in the history of thought, to name a single thinker who did not at some stage pontificate about it.
Can I extrapolate that the fact that I'm a terrible shopper is genetic? I mean, I buy ridiculous things. I don't know what I'm doing with it, or, you know, I bring them back. I never open it, whatever. Can I just extract that, oh, it's just I've inherited that and it's genetic?
There is a famous behavior geneticist called Turkheimer who proposed 3 laws, and one of them is that everything is heritable. That is to say that almost every human behavioral trait that's ever been studied is under some genetic influence. So I'm sure that applies to your shopping habits, too.
Well,
is that comforting?
Yeah, yes. Yes, it's an excuse. David Cesarini, he's a doctoral student in economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His study on genetics and financial choices appears in the current edition of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and you can see that at our website, here-now.org. So, David, enjoy that $11.
Thank you, I will.
And in 1 minute, Napoleon, failed leader, wonderful art collector. That's coming up here and now. When French General Napoleon Bonaparte created an empire rivaled in size only by that of ancient Rome, he also amassed one of the finest collections of art the world has ever seen. Now more than 200 decorative pieces from the early 19th century are on display at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston in an exhibit called Symbols of Power, Napoleon and the Art of Empire Style. As producer Kelly Horan explains, the show reveals much about a man who modeled himself after ancient kings, even as his famous name took on some unusual modern associations.
I think probably the unfortunate thing is that most people in America think Napoleon is a dessert.
Museum of Fine Arts Boston curator George Shackelford wants to set the record straight.
And in fact, it's the dessert that's named for the emperor.
And any resemblance between the two is entirely coincidental. With alternating layers of pastry, cream, and jam, the dessert is stacked high. The first emperor of France? Not so much. Guest curator Odile Nouvelle-Camerer from the Museum of Decorative Arts in Paris explains.
Il était petit, il avait 1m65. Petit.
He was small, she says, about 1m65. But do 5'6.5" merit an entire psychological complex? Well, here's something else for the record. The man whose name has become synonymous with short was actually of average height for his time and 4.5 inches taller than previously thought. Napoleon's stature will likely continue to rise thanks to a new exhibition at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. Symbols of Power charts the so-called Little Corsican's rise from arriviste general to ruler of most of Europe and beyond. Curator George Shackelford says two objects in particular encapsulate the story of Napoleon's ascent and illuminate the contrast between his private and public selves.
In one of the galleries, we see juxtaposed his campaign bed, very plain metal that could move from place to place as he was on the battlefield. And then we see his throne, which weighs 2 tons. It is a huge thing, you know, just completely covered with gold. I mean, it's an astonishing object of weight and power.
All that glittered in Napoleon's empire was great for public relations. But, says curator Odile Nouvelle-Camerer, Napoleon preferred the portable plain metal to the 2 tons of gilt.
All his life long, he was very, very suspicious. Il était très suspicieux for luxus. For luxury. And he used luxury only for diplomatic and political reasons.
Napoleon remembered what opulence had done for his predecessor, Louis XVI, and his queen, Marie Antoinette. He wasn't about to lose his head over luxury, so he dispensed with a serpentine line, Bombay profile, and Rococo frill of the pre-revolutionary period and embraced the clean, linear form, Roman arch, and functionality of the neoclassical. Odile Nouvelle-Camerer says the ascetic departure represented, above all, a political statement.
When blood run in the streets all days and cut the head of a lot of people, you cannot have the same way of life after than before a revolution. It's absolutely impossible. That's why the simplicity of forms were the only one way possible after this deep political break.
But restraint didn't figure in Napoleon's creation and manipulation of his own image. To boost his legitimacy after anointing himself emperor on December 2, 1804, Napoleon set out to establish himself as the direct descendant of Charlemagne and the Roman Emperor Augustus. To do so, he raided the ancient symbol closet. First, he chose the bee, symbol of immortality, resurrection, and the very origins of France. Next, it was time to decide which animal most embodied the power and character of his empire, the lion, the rooster, or the eagle of Jupiter, king of the Roman gods.
The lion was not so important, not so interesting for Napoleon, because the lion was adopted by many, many other countries. The cock was very interesting, because the cock is coming from very old ages in France. It was the animal of vigilance.
And for a time at least, it was Napoleon's first choice. As in America during the same period, poultry very nearly prevailed.
Well, remember that in the same time in the United States, Benjamin Franklin wanted our national bird to be the turkey, while Jefferson and others said it's got to be the eagle. And the eagle almost always wins out in such a debate.
It did in Napoleon's empire as well. And Napoleon didn't stop there. He commissioned countless portraits and works of art that told the story of a nation constantly at war and winning. And one portrait in particular captures all of it: the imperial destiny, the power, the link with the past. It is Napoleon I on his imperial throne by Jean-Auguste Dominique Ingres. The painting, says George Shackelford, embodies everything Napoleon sought to project.
From the scepter of Charlemagne to his imperial robes, covered over with embroidery and lined with ermine, to the great carpet that he stands upon, to the throne that stands behind him, it is an image of how the emperor surrounded himself with things of beauty and grandeur to further his cause.
Napoleon reportedly didn't like the painting when he first saw it. Neither did the public. It was pretty much dismissed as Byzantine, a bit over the top, at its unveiling in 1806. The French public is a famously tough crowd. And, says Odile Nouvelle-Cammerer, they still are, especially when it comes to their first emperor.
You know, French people today are very, very... ils sont très ennuyés par Napoléon. Je ne sais pas comment on dit ça.
They're bored with him.
Bored, no.
And
no,
annoyed
no.
with him.
Yes, they are very annoyed by Napoléon because it's a so difficult personality, so strong, but also with such important disasters in all Europe that it's very difficult for French people today to feel inheritors of Napoleon and of this period.
The exhibition will face the judgment of Paris when it moves to the French capital next year. By the time Napoleon faced his final judgment in 1815, he had lost everything. He spent his final years in exile on the island of St. Helena and died there in 1821. His successor, the anything but bellicose but entirely bourgeois citizen king, Louis XVIII, banished all emblems of Napoleon's reign, except one, that throne.
He kept it, but he removed from it the N from Napoleon at the top of the throne and the two eagles on each side, which were obviously two precise symbols of this very hated empire.
MFA director Malcolm Rogers recently named a chevalier, or a knight, of the arts by the French government, understands the appeal.
I fantasized about sitting on it, but the curator of the exhibition said she would fine me if I did.
Well, the chevalier is not a bad consolation prize.
Chevalier, but not an emperor.
Not yet.
Producer Kelly Horan. Symbols of Power at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston runs through January 27th of next year. And if your name is Napoleon, Bonaparte, or Josephine, you get in free with an ID. To see pictures from the exhibition, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.